Welcome to the Intercut Podcast Channel, the weekly place to hear the latest on movies, TV, and entertainment that people can't cut away from. I'm your co-host, Zachary Shevich, and joining me, we're in a tight spot. It's Arturo Zurita.
You know, if it had to come down to the who is the goofy and who is the tragedy of Macbeth between us, who do you think has got that? Because I think I could do the serious mode. I could be the Joel.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like you got the Joel haircut already. So I might have to be like the third Coen. I'll be the Coen that wrote all the other movies where they think it's a Coen brother, but he's the one with no age.
Do you want to be Roderick James? Maybe you could be Roderick
James.
I'll
be Roderick James. I'll take the editing easily.
Perfect. But yeah, like the Oh Brother, We're Out There cast, we need to make this duo a trio. So also joining us, he's a peculiar man. You might even say that he has principles. It's Taylor J. Williams. Thanks for joining us for another one of these bracket episodes. Always great to get you on these filmmaker analysis pods. Taylor?
Always happy to be back. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I mean, it's always fun going through some of our favorite filmmakers in this bracket style and trying to determine what we collectively think are their best movies. And with the Coen brothers, it's a really interesting set of movies to look into, because the Coens, for all of their singular qualities and really like inscrutable elements, they are a bit hard to predict. You know, they have some very wild, goofy comedies and some stark, really self-serious dramas and just about everything in between across different genres and time periods and locales. They are some of the most interesting filmmakers I think we have out there and have made a lot of my favorite films. Taylor, let me start with you. I think you do such a good job of summarizing this. Who are the Coen brothers as filmmakers together to you? Because we're getting some of them separate now, but together.
Of course. With the frayed movies, we're starting to see more of who's bringing what to the table.
Right.
Like you said, one is the goof, one is the doom and gloom. Supposedly. I don't want to be reductive. Yeah. And
reportedly, allegedly.
Yes, but like you said, they have this wide range tonally. They have these total off-the-wall comedies and these very bleak cosmic... I guess what I'm trying to get at is not only in tone do they have this polarity, but also in their tackling these like really theological and cosmic questions, but also grounding everything in such a sort of pedestrian, everyday lifestyle.
Totally.
So many of the characters they follow are just people going about their lives who happen to encounter these cosmic questions. And I also find that they sort of oscillate between this very palpable desire to do good with the medium and sort of help people and use what they're good at to, I don't know, make something meaningful out of their lives, and just sheer comic nihilism. So many of their movies end with just like the most fuck you, none of this mattered. But yeah. I think in all of the, like you said, they also have a lot of in between, but I think even at their most polar opposites, you know, in their darkest films, there's still a very like underlying comic tone to it, be it the character actors or the dialogue rhythms or the editing, and even in their most laugh out loud comedies or whatever, there's a really existential dread to the most inane side remarks, and to me that's like the best way to describe them. They're definitely someone I've had trouble pinning down the core of, because they like to sort of jump back and forth so much, but that's also what makes them such exciting filmmakers.
That nihilism, but also the ability to laugh in the face of it, is that contrast that's kind of, I think, at the heart of that inability to pin them down that you talk about, right? Like they are able to kind of do both things so well simultaneously in a way that takes you by surprise oftentimes. Like you're not expecting to laugh at the like existentialist dramas the way you do, and you're not expecting to think as much about the goofy Looney Tunes-esque comedies that they make too. Arturo, do you view them equal auteurs in terms of their dramatic heft and their comedic abilities? Do you skew one way or the other in terms of the movies that you like from the Coen brothers?
No, because I think they do a really good job at having something as goofy as a guy who just goes by the dude. And then, you know, No Country for Old Men, that seems like doesn't really, you know, evoke a lot of laughter from it. But, like, the fact that they could go from all of these different tones, that they make bad movies and we don't even include them in these brackets because nobody thinks about them, showcases, like, how much at the forefront they are. And I feel like a lot of the times the prestige that directors like these guys get comes from, like, very serious people. And I think in, like, over time, people have found out Nolan isn't this stuffy guy that people thinks that he is. And the same thing with the Coen brothers. The more you hear them talk, they're goofballs. Like, they're not approaching this, both of them, in this way that people think is, like, very self-serious, but almost, like, in a funny way. Even, like, one of the breakdowns for a big movie that we had was Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou? And it's, like, their whole approach to that, that Francis Ford Coppola came out and said, it's like The Odyssey, but with a bunch of idiots, and he called it The Idiocy. And it's, like, they know how to approach these really hefty things. Maybe one does it with a palette that's a little bit more somber and it's a little bit more serious, whereas the other one has that goofiness, but you put them together and that's when you get the best films. Even when they're working together and they lean one way or the other, I think they've been the best together, and I hope they continue in the future.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we're coming off of the debut of Ethan Coen's solo project, Driveway Dolls, which feels like the polar opposite of the self-serious Joel Coen Tragedy of Macbeth movie. And, you know, it's led to a really interesting situation where you can kind of take those films and then retroactively look back through their entire filmography and pick apart, well, like, this is obviously an Ethan-influenced moment. This is obviously a Joel-influenced moment. But, yeah, I mean, I think when Roderick you hear them... moment. That's the thing, is when you hear them speak, I think it's a lot more Roger James, right? It's a lot more.
Yeah.
There is a sort of like ESP that they have, that they do seem like they're really working on a very similar wavelength, that they're both able to influence those, both of those sides to their stories. You know, you look through their history, and there are certain elements that distinguish them. Ethan being the one who went off to Princeton and got a degree in philosophy, Joel being the one who went to NYU and got the film degree and began working as an assistant editor, and has more of the inclination towards the kind of like fancy camera technique and using the kind of like element of violence in their movies, whereas Ethan maybe is the one more predisposed to make jokes about like dildos and, you know, seeing a naked woman over a picket fence. But like it is when they are together that they're able to kind of scratch both itches simultaneously, for not having a better way of phrasing it. I don't know. They're such interesting filmmakers. I really enjoy looking at their work. We have the 16 movies that we think are the most representative of what they do on this bracket. We left some stuff off. Only two feature films that they've done did not make our bracket. They're two least popular, according to Letterboxd, those being Intolerable Cruelty from 2003 and The Lady Killers from 2004. Arturo, you think you've seen Lady Killers at least, right?
I don't know why I remember exactly what theater I was in my hometown, but when you told me that this was a Coen Brothers movie, I was like, no, this is somebody else's movie. No one's going to put Tom Hanks in like this really messed up beard just to like murder. It's like Ocean's 8, but like they're killing a woman inside of her house. It has the tones that you would expect from like a Coen Brothers movie, but it didn't have the quality. And I felt the same way when you know, you mentioned the other one of them keeping their partnership with Clooney, but doing a rom-com that I guess they don't get to commit to all the way because it's in their style, but it has to feed the machine that is a rom-com, and it's almost like setting it up for failure, even if it is one of the movies that was financially successful for them.
Right. And there are people who defend intolerable cruelty.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, but I think one of the interesting things about the Coens is that lots of their films have, like, stark defenders. And almost every film in their filmography will find somebody out there who's like, actually, this is the best one that they've done. So We also didn't include Paris J'aime. I don't speak French. I don't know how to pronounce that. But it is, a set of short films from different filmmakers, and they have one of the segments in it. So figured it was worth leaving it off of there. We also didn't include any of the movies that they have writing credits on. Those would include 1985's Crime Wave, which was directed by Sam Raimi, one of their early collaborators. Joel, in fact, was hired as an assistant director on The Evil Dead, which is where met Raimi, and they began their collaborations. Later on, they also did uncredited rewrites on Bad Santa, one of my favorite little fun facts about them.
And which weirdly EPs.
Which weirdly makes sense to me. I kind of can see their, like, really frank sense of humor matching up with the deadpan absurdity in that movie. They wrote the movie Gambit in 2012 for director Michael Hoffman. Have either of you guys seen this one?
No.
I didn't register with me. It's got pretty bad reviews as far as I can tell. That's kind of a weird through line with a lot of the movies that they wrote but did not direct it. They get significantly worse reviews than the movies that they just wrote and directed. The next one being 2014's Unbroken from Angelina Jolie.
I totally did not know
they wrote that.
I don't think they're the only credited writers on it, but they did have a hand in Unbroken. Do either of you, like, distinctly remember this movie? I don't think I've seen it in at least a decade.
I remember it coming out, but I never saw it.
Unbroken was really good. It was, what's-his-name's directorial debut, no?
Angelina Jolie?
No, Roger Deakins. Didn't he make that movie? And Angelina Jolie was there?
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it looked good.
Right? This one got a lot of hype because it was able to get the Oscar campaign, and it was able to also get a lot of, like, religious people into theaters. Yeah. And it was really pitched as that. So because I know it, like, as a religious movie, you telling me that the Coens have something to do with this? Crazy.
Probably the best movie that they wrote but did not direct is 2015, am I right? Yeah, 2015's Bridge of Spies. Taylor, is that a Spielberg that you like or a Spielberg that you're mixed on?
I like it for the most part. It's not like, I don't know, it doesn't rise to the top when I think about Spielberg, but I don't know. I've seen a lot of scenes from it since I watched it. I haven't seen it since it came out. And, you know, just looking at these, like, one-off clips, I've had a lot of moments where I'm like, you know, maybe this movie was a little better than I thought.
Right. I feel like I have the same experience with it, where I was not super high on it at the time that it came out, but there's all these elements of it that I either remember or get, like, shown to me again on Twitter or something like that. It's like, maybe there's a little bit more than I gave it credit for at the time.
Yeah.
And then they also co-wrote Suburbicon, the 2017 George Clooney movie that got buried after some of its bad reviews. So, again, not the best track record. So maybe when they don't like their scripts, they pawn them off on lesser directors or something like that. As far as the solo movies, we mentioned Tragedy of Macbeth and Drive Away Dolls. They each have one under their belt, but Ethan also co-directed the Jerry Lee Lewis documentary Trouble in Mind from A24 back in 2022. Not that I've had the chance to see it, but curious that that's somebody that he would want to profile in a movie that he made with Trisha Cook before they ended up going on to Drive Away Dolls.
I think it was one of the inner cuties who had said in the chat earlier that it was like they split so that they could both make movies with their wives. And hopefully the boys come back together down the line.
Exactly. Maybe for that horror movie that we're seeing rumors about. I don't know.
I hope.
Definitely. All right. So let's get into the bracket, the 16 best Coen Brothers movies. We have them organized as usual in terms of when they came out, with the first two films, Blood Simple and Raising Arizona, in the first matchup, and the most recent features, Hail Caesar and Ballad of Buster Scruggs, in the last one. Why don't we kick things off right at the start? Blood Simple, Raising Arizona. Blood Simple, of course, their first film, came out in 1984. The second one, Raising Arizona, in 1987. Taylor, I know that this is one of the ones that you caught up with recently. So did Raising Arizona, do you like, now that you've seen it, do you like Raising Arizona more than Blood Simple?
I would say so. I was actually pretty blown away by Raising Arizona.
Yeah.
It was one of those that, I don't know, I was aware of its reputation as sort of cementing who the Coens were. Blood Simple is this sort of, I don't know, sort of perceived as an exercise almost, or mm-hmm. a proof of concept. And I feel like Raising Arizona is where they really cemented their range and their more comical sensibilities. Not that that's exactly absent from Blood Simple. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I just had a great time with it. It's such a sweet movie. And again, just casually dropping all of these one-off remarks about restorative justice and these deep philosophical concepts that it just mentions once and then brushes into the Looney Tunes antics. And mm-hmm. It's so casual, but you don't forget about it. And these things sort of, I don't know, add this, not exactly necessary, but this depth to the antics. Like, as just a stupid comedy or whatever, it would still probably be in the upper half of their films for me. But, I don't know, just knee-jerk reaction, having just very recently seen it. It's pretty close to the top, I would say.
Nice, nice. Art, do you feel similarly, or are you more of a fan of Blood Simple?
So I got to see Blood Simple for the first time. I had seen Raising Arizona a while ago, revisiting both of them. I see what Taylor's saying, because it's like Blood Simple kind of has the inklings of what they have, but it's such a twist to go to Raising Arizona. That's like, mm-hmm. they're so comfortable. It's like there's a lot of directors or even artists who it's their second album that people consider their first. I always think like Kendrick, they go to that second one right away because this is the style they're going to have throughout. Blood Simple was impressive to me, having not seen it. I thought it was really cool for a debut. I found out that it won Sundance, like the second ever Sundance. This was the winner. It won the Indie Spirit Awards. They tied with Scorsese for Best Director, I think, at the Indie Spirit Awards for this. But it's Raising Arizona, dude. This, I don't know how they do it on this whole rewatch. Every single time Frances McDormand appeared, I don't understand how they get a completely different performance out of her. And she is just a side character in this. This one was a blast. This is, you guys have been saying, this Looney Tune antics type of energy that they have. It's full throttle in Raising Arizona. There's this baby scene when he's trying to capture the kids. Like, it feels so vibrant all these years later. And I got to give it to Raising Arizona. But shout out Blood Simple. Really, really solid movie.
Yeah, Blood Simple, I really, really enjoyed when I think I first saw it. Like, I think you see a lot of the building blocks that would then turn into films like No Country for Old Men, particularly the sort of like quiet assembly of these set pieces. But I don't know, maybe it's because I first saw Raising Arizona as like a rerun on Comedy Central when I was young, but like I feel like I've always underestimated that movie. It is so funny, and there's just a density to jokes and characterizations that I think are really, really interesting in that. So, and plus it's got just incredible performances from Nick Cage, Holly Hunter.
Yes,
so
sir.
Yeah, I think it's a clean sweep for Raising Arizona in the first matchup. Our second matchup is going to be between Miller's Crossing and Barton Fink. Art, which way do you lean between these two films?
I'm pretty tied. I'm pretty even. I like Barton Fink. I think what it does for like a writer's perspective and this like agony that he's going through with, you know, just the disgustingness of the wallpaper falling off and continuing to happen. I'm going to edge it out to Miller's Crossing because it is an underrated gangster flick, dude. It is so good. An incredible opening. An incredible John Turturro. And the iconography of the hat in the woods, I'm going to have to give it to Miller's, dude. Just by a little bit, though. Just by a little bit.
I was hoping to like Miller's a little bit more. That's one of the ones that I hadn't seen going into this bracket. And I found myself really responding to Barton Fink. Again, another one that I hadn't seen going into the bracket. Just the way in which it kind of is a mixture of his experience as it is and experience as it is in its head. I don't know. In the current year, it reminded me of seeing Beau Is Afraid. Just the way that...
I can see that.
it sort of like extrapolates on different elements of what he's thinking, how he's feeling, and just the descent into chaos towards the end of that movie is so, I don't know, it there's something so cinematic to it. I really love that John Goodman performance, the John Turturro performance as well. I think this is also like the beginnings of a lot of the actors that would recur throughout the Coen brothers' filmography, although I guess Turturro is also in Miller's Crossing. I think Buscemi is too.
And Goodman's in Arizona. He's fantastic.
Yeah, true, true. I'm going to go with Barton Fink and let Taylor make the tough decision.
Yeah, I think I'm also going to go with Barton Fink. I'm a little on the fence. Miller's Crossing, I agree, it's very underrated, and I think it's got some incredible physical comedy, and I don't know, I just think about the bit where the guy's just getting lit up with the Tommy gun, and it's just, right, it just keeps going.
Yes!
And not only is that just like a great bit, but it is also kind of like playing into the same conversation as like The Godfather and the mm-hmm. the Sonny shootout calling back to Bonnie and Clyde. I feel like it's very much inserting itself into that tradition a little bit.
Canon,
but
yeah.
Taking it into such this ridiculous territory. But Barton Fink is so interesting because I'm pretty sure they wrote it when they were having writer's block with Miller's Crossing. And so I see it as sort of them having it both ways a little bit. Like they still, it's the setting is pretty similar to Miller's Crossing, very much this Art Deco presentation. But yeah, just the mechanical rollout of information. I don't know, seeing it right after Raising Arizona, I guess I for some reason expected it to be a lot more like off the wall and chaotic and stuff, but it's so controlled, and I don't know, Miller's Crossing is too, and I think it's doing both of these brackets, I feel like both sets of movies pair with each other so nicely.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of interesting to knock one of them out so early on.
Yeah.
But yeah, Barton Fink just for me takes so much of what I enjoy of the just the sensory experience of Miller's Crossing and mm-hmm. goes so much deeper, and just on like a level of like one-liners and stuff, all these moments just like getting at the truth of like is this even worth it, is this doing anything, I as this privileged screenwriter and you know I have this lofty conception of what I do, maybe I'm just talking over everyone around me, and just watching that guilt fester, which I think John Goodman's performance really sells. Obviously, you have all these scenes where he's trying to tell Barton a story, and then Barton interrupts him to keep philosophizing, but just the early, every delivery John Goodman has before the big reveal, you can't tell if he really is just some, like, Joe Schmo, or if he is, like, actively being condescending, and
yeah,
you know, he's like, oh, but you know, I wouldn't understand a big brain thought like that. it really is a little unscrutable how much he is just like, I don't know, kind of a nice guy, and you really do buy into their friendship for a while,
yeah,
despite that push and pull. But there is just something one degree off with every delivery, and again, just very controlled, and yeah, I got to give it to Barton.
Yeah, it does a great job of unsettling you without necessarily like going full out and being disturbing. Just sort of that tinge of discomfort throughout is so so palpable. But yeah, Miller's Crossing. I wonder if it's maybe speaking in a dialogue of gangster film that I'm like less familiar in than the Coen brothers are, and yeah, maybe there's like elements
that's
of
why
that
I mess with it. It's yeah, cool, but hey, shout out Miller's Crossing, it's dope, and Barton Fink is definitely stand up.
Let's go to Hudsucker Proxy versus Fargo. Hudsucker Proxy was another one of the ones that I caught up with for this bracket, and of the ones that I hadn't seen prior to assembling this podcast, this is the one that I responded to the most strongly. I thought it was pretty incredible, this mix of like a Looney Tunes kind of aesthetic with this like corporate satire. You have these amazing performances from Tim Robbins, Jennifer Jason Leigh, Paul Newman, but particularly the Jennifer Jason Leigh, like his girl Friday routine is just, it really, really works for me here. They co-wrote this movie with Sam Raimi. And I think you can see sort of some of the outlandishness that Raimi was known for in the way they go through some of these, the way they assemble some of these moments. I just think it's so fun, has such a ridiculous sense of humor and sense of style too. The production design of it is so like simultaneously extravagant but also muted, that when they finally get to like the reveal of the back half of that movie, like the color pops so much. I really, really like this one. I don't imagine most people would have it over Fargo, and I'm not even sure I have it over Fargo, but I did want to at least put that on the record before we all give this one to Fargo, because it's
you still go Fargo?
I don't know if I can't go Fargo. Like, it's, Fargo is amazing. Right? So I'll go.
But it's such an underrated gem. Yeah, I think the beauty of the Hudsucker Proxy is that while it's one of the like worst financial movies that they had, it's for a reason. It's because of what they're saying. I believe this is the one that when they tested it, they're like, you need to change, and they defiantly were like, no, we're not changing a single thing. They release it exactly the way they wanted to, and I think because of that, it's slow for people to like find it, but when they do, yeah, it's fantastic. And it's for kids.
All right, so we'll give this matchup to Fargo, but just consider this an endorsement of Hudsucker Proxy. If you haven't seen that one, that's definitely one that's worth catching up
with. I have not.
Okay, then, yeah. It's not for kids. I didn't mean it like that. It's a line.
It's a line. It's a good line of the movie. The bit with the pants is like,
yes,
maybe the hardest that I've laughed at a joke in some time. It is so,
it's funny, bro.
Ridiculous.
I'm definitely gonna get to that soon.
Please let me know.
Like Zach said,
this
is one of those where you can catch it like on Canopy with a library card and it's free.
Yeah.
Which is awesome.
There we go. All right, the next matchup is between The Big Lebowski and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? This is another one where, like, I feel like we're doing wrong if we don't pick the Big Lebowski. But I love Oh Brother, Where Art Thou so much. Just the way that the Coens tackle their version of like a movie musical between this and Llewyn Davis, it's so interesting. And going along this Odyssey-like journey with Turturro, Tim Blake Nelson, and George Clooney is so good. Man of Constant Sorrow is just like one of my favorite musical moments in a movie ever. It makes me laugh so much. I made sure to rewatch it this morning before we started recording. Again, though, Big Lebowski's probably better.
Big Lebowski.
Yeah.
Big Lebowski's like a movie where even if you don't know about the Coen brothers, like, I think people know about The Big Lebowski. It's one of those movies that's made it so big.
Taylor, do you like Oh Brother?
I like Oh Brother. I definitely like Big Lebowski a little bit more. Or actually, probably quite a bit more. I'm like kind of relatively lukewarm on Big Lebowski. I think it's still up there for me, but I'm not as much of a disciple as many.
The dude disciple?
Yes.
The people who love Lebowski love Lebowski.
No, exactly. That's the only reason.
Yeah.
Dudism, like, they're out there.
Like, I like it a lot, but I'm not, I don't know, gung-ho for it.
Gotcha.
And I probably wouldn't put it in my Coen top five, maybe number Same. Six. But I would say I have it above Oh Brother. A lot of great stuff going on in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou. Such an entertaining movie. But I don't think the emotional impact of it quite compares to the gut punch of Lebowski and just totally taking the wind out of your sails at the end. And also, I think both of them are, like so many of their movies, playing into a certain tradition of storytelling, be it noir or the epic poem. And they're both sort of putting their stamp on it. I think of the two, The Big Lebowski, to me, has probably more compelling narrative and character ideas and just stuff like all the repeating dialogue that he hears, that he repeats to other characters. And I don't know, if by no other metric, just the number of bits I can rattle off from Lebowski versus Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, I'm going Lebowski.
Definitely.
Yeah. Shout out Oh Brother for creating color correction. Roger Deakins was like, I don't know how to like do this, and he just created color correction, so that's awesome. I know we had a shout out Wiley. He, our patron, was like really hyping Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, talking about how it was like a Grammy Award winning album for it, and was really hyping up the music more than anything. I've always seen it for its visuals because of that. That's what I studied from it.
It was like a landmark. It was like the first movie to have a separate soundtrack release, sort of. Maybe not eclipse the movie itself, but be sort of its own separate phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. So I thought that was awesome for it. Rewatching the trailer, because I didn't get to revisit the whole thing. There's like, and again, I have to sit through the whole thing. What they're commenting with these three guys and the journey that they're going through and the different perspectives they've never gone through, it did make me more, I'm really intrigued to revisit it to see the commentary that they're saying with these specific characters, not just in line with obviously it being the Odyssey, but in particular, like what they're going through as three dudes in America. But The Big Lebowski is The Big Lebowski, and I got to go there.
I just really love, I had completely forgotten about it till I rewatched it, the section with in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou with Michael Badalucco playing Babyface Nelson, just like shooting it at the cops and getting so offended when somebody calls him Babyface, just sadly walking out of the bank, shooting off his gun. It's so classic. But we'll go with The Big Lebowski over Oh Brother, Where Art Thou. Our next matchup is between The Man Who Wasn't There, a 2001 release, and No Country for Old Men, a 2007 release. If you think that's a long gap between movies, that's because we left off both Intolerable Cruelty and The Lady Killers from this period. This is also the period I should have mentioned earlier when Ethan starts getting co-director credit. Up through the first few movies, it was Joel getting director credit and Ethan just credited as a producer, although reportedly they were, you know, sitting next to each other and basically co-directing all these movies. And then they finally decided to share co-directing credits on The Lady Killers. Yeah, not a great track record with that. But anyway, we have The Man Who Wasn't There versus No Country for Old Men. And I feel like this is another one where we all know who's going to win this matchup. But I do want to put a little bit of respect on The Man Who Wasn't There's name. Again, visiting this for this bracket, I found it to be like, just beautifully shot. You know, Roger Deakins doing the black and white cinematography. Just the use of shadows is so noticeable. But I found it to be like really melancholy and tragic. Just there's this really like sad element to it, and forlorn kind of quality that the Billy Bob Thornton performance has, and where he feels so repressed and like he's just has like the worst luck and nothing going for him. I don't know.
Little like a serious man. They'd like that tone of
maybe some of the totally like sort of like the existential search for meaning from a meaningless existence. It, definitely some of the early elements of that here. So like, it's another one of those ones that I think is one of the least seen or least talked about movies in the Coen Brothers filmography, but I think there's a lot of worthwhile stuff there. But again, I'm definitely voting No Country for Old Men.
Yeah, and you also have a very young Scarlett Johansson here. I remember when I first saw her, I was like, yo, she's been acting since like the beginning. I know she plays the pianist in there, but shout out Lady Killers. If he doesn't get the credit there, then in 07, he doesn't get the gold when he wins Best Director. So
exactly.
That was good, because I also like the speeches at the Oscars. They're pretty funny.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about Burn After Reading versus A Serious Man. Serious Man, I think, is a lot of people, high on a lot of people's Coen Brothers rankings, but how do you feel about Burn After Reading, Taylor?
I'm a pretty big fan of Burn After Reading. I think this is probably the toughest round one bracket so far. I'm a big fan of both, and to me, they both sort of occupy a very similar, I don't know, space and, like, tone and obviously proximity in their release dates and stuff. I don't know. I feel like it's kind of this middle period for them after such a, like, titanic moment with No Country for Old Men. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of, I don't know. I'm always interested in these periods in directors' careers after their sort of landmark film where they're still on top of their game, but they're just kind of putting out bangers, and it's like they have no gravity, even though they're, like, as good as anything else they've put out, just, like, sort of in the wake of the sort of metatextual moment or whatever, they don't necessarily get the same gravity. And I feel like Burn After Reading and A Serious Man both occupy that space for me. And I also think they're both sort of opposite sides of that polarity we were talking about at the start. Serious Man being this very introspective, theological reckoning of existence, and Burn After Reading being a total farce, literally ending with the line, like, what do we learn from this? Fuck if I know. And so, I don't know. It's, I think I skew Burn After Reading probably just because I've seen it more times than A Serious Man. Mm-hmm. But this is a really tough one for me.
All right. I'll ask Art to make the first tough decision then.
I'm going Burn After Reading.
Oh, you are going Burn After
I'm just saying it's tough for me to.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah. One vote for one. What I'm going next? I'm voting for A Serious Man. I like Burn After Reading a lot. I just showed it to you recently, Art, when we were together, because like there's so many great bits in Burn After Reading, and the performances particularly, like, it is a bit of a tragedy that this is the only time that Brad Pitt has played a complete goof for the Coen brothers, because he fits in so perfectly to their tone. Great Frances McDormand performance. Titanically funny J.K. Simmons performance. I'm sorry, not J.K. Simmons. John Malkovich performance. Just the way he, like, screams at people in this movie is so good. And I love it a lot, but I'm going to go with A Serious Man.
After rewatching both, I think I'd want to rewatch Burn After Reading before A Serious Man.
Does that get your vote, though?
I can't believe it, because we started this entire podcast, this entire Coen's bracket, by talking about how underrated A Serious Man is. Zach even hit me last week. He goes, you need to rewatch A Serious Man. You're going to get things that your brain could not handle when you were younger. But I think I'm going Burn After Reading after watching both, and I could be wrong.
Wow.
And tomorrow's Art can come and get me, but I think Burn After Reading is my pick for this.
Okay. Okay.
I really want to revisit A Serious Man.
You should. It's interesting. I know the intro had nothing to do with the rest of the movie. I Googled it. I'm like, what does this have to do with anything? They're like, I don't know. We thought it was funny. I guess there's kind of themes in there. I don't know if it was the ending that really got to me at the time, because it's just like, wow, can you do that? But then the Burn After Reading, like Taylor was saying, kind of does a version of it. And it reminds me of, do you know Killing Them Softly? Which also has Brad Pitt. It reminds me, like, that type of ending where it just smacks you at the end. And I don't know, having watched it with you, and I just saw A Serious Man last night, I could be wrong tomorrow, but I think Burn After Reading edges it out after being older and giving it a rewatch. And there's something about the goofiness in there. You're talking about Brad Pitt's performance. His final shot.
Just that smile.
Is so funny.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Tell me about A Serious Man, though. Convince me. This is the part. So, this is where we get into that bit.
So I don't think that the intro bit has nothing to do with the rest of it. I think that
I'm just quoting the directors.
I know they like to sort of, like, deflate their own movies, but I think that ultimately what the intro and a lot of the movie is about is sort of like the fruitless search for meaning in a yeah. life that doesn't provide answers, right? Like both the answer to the question of like, is he a Dybbuk is just as answerable as like, what is the meaning of life? Like you can rack your brain and go crazy trying to find those answers, and ultimately you will come up short, and the way you have to go through life is just by looking at the parking lot, Larry. You just look at the parking lot. So I don't know. I love a serious
Burn
man.
After reading said, keep your mind, keep it, mind your own business. That's like the funniest premise.
I think I have a serious man at number one on my Coen brothers rankings. So this is a little bit of a sad moment for me, but it's okay. I love Burn After Reading too.
That's what you get for out of all the Coen brothers movie, you wanted to watch that one with me.
Yeah. Next time I won't show you anything. All right, let's talk Zach. About True Grit versus Inside Llewyn Davis. Inside Llewyn Davis is probably the last Coen brothers movie to be considered like one of their classics. I think this is one of the ones that people hold up as one of the best ones. Art, do you like it more than True Grit though?
Yes, but I'm rewatching True Grit. Bless that girl. She was saying lines a minute. She deserved that nomination.
Yeah, I mean, like, it is a real star-making turn for Hailee Steinfeld, and there's a reason she stuck around, I guess. She's really phenomenal in that movie. Everybody is kind of phenomenal in that movie. Does the movie lose... I didn't rewatch True Grit for this. Does the movie lose some of its charm when you can turn closed captioning on for Jeff Bridges?
Yeah, it's like the opposite of Tenet.
All right, so I'm gonna also go with Inside Llewyn Davis. So I think that means it wins this matchup.
Yeah, I haven't seen True Grit.
Were you ever like just never interested in you, or
I just never got around to it.
Gotcha. It was also the era where Jeff Bridges has decided. And I'm like, I was not vibing with that. It was this movie, and then the next one where he was like the singer, and I don't know. I missed the earlier. Jeff Bridges.
Yeah, Taylor doesn't like when they remake John Wayne movies, so
had to take a principled stance.
All right, our last first round matchup is between Hail Caesar and The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. Hail Caesar, it's hard to believe, but it's been since 2016 since we got a full feature from the Coens, because Ballad of Buster Scruggs is that anthology. So like, yeah, it's feature length, but it's a bunch of shorts they put together. Not Hail Caesar is probably close to one of their least well-reviewed movies. It's another one of the ones that I think I considered for leaving off the bracket, but I did find out that Taylor has a pretty high rating for Hail Caesar. So are you going with this one over Ballad of Buster Scruggs? Can you convince us?
Absolutely. I rewatched it over the summer, and I was like, when it came out, I thought it was like so mid, just like, I don't know, a pleasant time, some What's goofy the antics. But I don't know. I feel like this movie is sort of doing what Babylon was trying to do in like indicting the Hollywood system, but it's actually playing into the sort of overlit studio language of those films. But it's still very much like a late period film, and it doesn't feel like I feel like thematically it's covering a lot of the same ground as Barton Fink, reckoning with the ethics of movies themselves. You know, is this business actually doing anything for the people, or have we just created a cash-grabbing monster that's sort of grown out of our control? And it has this one moment. I don't remember if it's during the No Dames number or during the mermaid sequence with Scarlett Johansson, where like for like 5 seconds it cuts to just like total bird's eye view of the studio, and the sound design is so metallic, and it just, there's so many moments like that where it just frames the whole studio system as this, like, I don't know, commercial, I don't know. There's just so much self-loathing there. But again, it's one of those movies that you really feel like there's this longing to do something good with this thing that has been around for 100 years now, with so much time and resources and lives put into. And I don't know. I guess what clicked for me this time around was how the visual language played into that. Because, you know, when I saw it and it came out, I was like, oh, it was kind of flat looking, whatever. Mm-hmm. I do think it actually looks pretty good for the most part, but so much more it hit as like playing into the style and cinematography of those Technicolor mid-1950s big studio films. And for if not for those reasons, then I would put it above Ballad of Buster Scruggs for Hobie Doyle alone. I think he's a top five Coen character, should have jump-started Alden Ehrenreich's career. And
would that it was so simple.
Would that it were so simple, you know? But yeah, really had an eye-opening experience rewatching that movie a couple months ago.
All right, you're making me want to rewatch it.
It's a good break, Art, comparing it to Babylon, for sure.
Yeah. Art.
But... you know what? I actually am. I think I have Ballad of Buster Scruggs rated a little higher, and I cannot remember anything from that movie, but that scene, Torta Tornado, so we quote like every other month on Intercut, so I'm going Hail Caesar for that alone.
Whoa,
and
wow.
For your dissertation.
Hell yeah.
All right. Fair enough. I guess I'll throw a little bit of love Ballad of Buster Scruggs' way. You know, I do really love the whole Tim Blake Nelson opening with when a cowboy trades his spurs for wings. Just goofy fun. And, you know, it's got... I was trying to think, is this the Coen Brothers movie that spawned the biggest meme? Because
yes!
That James Franco I'm first time
tired
thing is...
of the meme.
So there's that. But I also really like the meal ticket segment. That's probably my favorite of them with, I think it's Liam Neeson and Harry Melling in that one. But yeah, I mean, it's probably similarly like a late period kind of slighter effort. But I think there's some fun moments in Buster Scruggs. But happy
you have
to
it above,
give
like midway point for you?
No,
personally?
It's definitely it's okay. Outside of my top 10, as is Hail okay. Caesar. But yeah. We'll put Hail Caesar through to the next round. And before we get started, I do have a quick pop quiz for y'all. Wondering if you know the most frequent collaborators with the Coen brothers, because they have some people who they've worked with a lot, both in front of and behind the camera. Taylor, you have any guesses for either role?
I mean, I'd say John Goodman, first guess. Yep.
John Goodman's a great one. He's been in 7 Coen Brothers movies. There's one actor he's tied with and one that's been in more. Art, any guess?
Frances McDormand is the tie?
Frances McDormand is the one who's been in the most. She's been in 9 of their films, that's... which makes a lot of sense. This is okay. Mrs. Coen. Any other guesses for who's on the top list?
JT.
JT? Which JT?
John Turturro?
Oh, Turturro. Right. He's been in 4. There's been 4 actors who've been in 4. 2 actors who've been in 5.
Clooney?
Clooney's also been in 4. The other 2 actors who've been in 4 are Warren Keith and Bruce Campbell.
Bro. Ooh, okay.
I figured you weren't going to get those 2.
Yeah, I wasn't going to get that.
There's one actor who's been in 7 of them. I feel like
Steve
I mentioned
Buscemi.
Him already. There we go. Steve Buscemi. Okay. Buscemi's been in 7. John Polito and Stephen Root have each been in 5. Michael okay. Badalucco, Josh Brolin, Richard Jenkins, and J.K. Simmons have been in 3. As for behind the camera, Carter Burwell has scored all of their films.
Hey.
And wow. Some of those scores are some of my favorite film scores of all time. But also, Roger Deakins has shot 10 of their movies. 11, nice. If we want to count Unbroken in there.
hey, that shows you like exactly why. I know I was making the Angelina joke, but they were helping their buddy direct the first film.
Exactly.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, so that's our pop quiz. Let's get to the second round of the bracket and make some tough decisions, starting with Raising Arizona versus Barton Fink. Arturo, why don't you go first?
I feel like you guys are going to pick Barton Fink, which I would agree with as well. So to make it a little even, I'm going to go the funny side and do Raising Arizona.
All right. All right. Taylor, is that how you feel?
No, I'm going Raising Arizona.
Ooh, okay.
I like Barton Fink a lot, but and again, these two being the two that I watched like so recently in preparation for the bracket. I don't know. I like so much of what Barton Fink is doing, but I feel like Raising Arizona is so influential. I feel like, you know, we talk about how much Wes Anderson owes to the Coen brothers. There's a lot of Bottle Rocket, especially here. But I also think Raising Arizona has a lot of Lynch-isms in it. Obviously, a lot of Wild at Heart. But also, I feel like those early Coen films have this motif of like really low camera driving on a middle of nowhere road that like I don't think David Lynch started doing that until like Twin Peaks, maybe. Maybe with Wild at Heart. But I don't know. I feel like
some of that stuff almost feels Raimi-esque to me.
Dude, that's a good point. Figuring out that worked with him, it's like, oh, that's how you guys are getting all of these like sweeping shots. When he swoops up to get the huggies, I had a replay that I was like, how'd you do that cleanly? Sam Raimi being, you know, an influence 100% works.
Was Raimi second unit on Raising Arizona? I remember rewatching something and seeing he was the second unit guy.
I would not be surprised. The scene where High is dreaming about the motorcycle guy literally just copies the Evil Dead shot, like going into the house. Weird thing about, or maybe not weird thing, it's a consistent thing between the two movies, Raising Arizona and Barton Fink, is they both have this possibly imagined figure that has this trail of fire behind him that is representing on some level damnation that I don't think reappears in any of their other movies. And maybe like the highway thing, they were just on that kind of kick back then. But again, that was like one of the things that stood out to me watching those two in conjunction. obviously a lot of theological weight there, but still such, I don't know, comically hyperbolic presentation.
Brother has that cop, kinda. I wouldn't say he's got the fire behind him, but I know there's that police officer with the no eyes.
You're reminding me, though, that like they did play with fire a lot in this era, between that moment in Raising Arizona, burning down the house in the shootout moment in Miller's Crossing, the end of Barton Fink. They have, you mentioned, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? They burned down the barn in the beginning of that, so maybe that's his like Pyros. Film school violent roots or something like that. any other thoughts on Raising Arizona, or are we moving on to our next matchup?
Raising Arizona, all the way.
Cool. All right. So Fargo versus the.
Wait,
Big
did you pick one though? We didn't get you on the record.
Oh, I. Come on, this is a tough one for me. I'll throw some love Barton Fink's way since neither of you did.
All right.
but that's honestly one that can go either way for me.
Look, if you guys are mentioning references, when he popped out, Alina goes, oh my gosh, Shawshank. And I'm like, nah, baby, that's years before Shawshank.
Yeah. Like,
you know?
Exactly.
So you have to give respect.
Good point. All right. Next matchup is Fargo versus The Big Lebowski. I feel like if you ask a random person to name a Coen Brothers movie, these are going to be like your top two Family Feud answers, right? Like it's the classic comedy and the classic like Oscar nominated movie. Although like, maybe No Country surpassed it in that regard, but two all timers for sure. Arturo, do you want to start us off? Fargo versus The Big Lebowski?
It's hard. So my anchor point here is going to be John Goodman's performance in The Big Lebowski. It has to be. So by a little, The Big Lebowski.
Really? Okay. Taylor, how about you? Are you going Fargo or The Big Lebowski?
I'm going Fargo. Again, love The Big Lebowski. I'm maybe a little, just a hair more ambivalent toward it than Fargo.
That's your opinion, man.
And I don't know. Fargo is like, I think the staple of their just like sort of everyday ground level. I don't know, ethos. And again, it is a movie that very much feels like, oh, it's all for nothing. None of this ended up mattering. But there is that sort of emotional undercurrent at the end where it is sort of championing the little guy a little bit, and just those everyday moments, even though it's in the context of this ridiculous murder plot. And also so many of their most iconic moments, I think, happen in this movie. Obviously the wood chipper, the car shootout itself. And I don't know. I think some of this might be retroactive just because of the Fargo show, but that there was such a mythology. What?
You've seen the all four?
I've seen Fargo seasons. I haven't seen the new season 5, but I've seen the first 4 seasons.
Okay, because that's my thing with Fargo. It's like to create that in your future. I've heard they kind of don't like the show, which is kind of crazy to me because it's like an incredible offshoot of it and kind of what you were saying about the way it's connected.
Yeah, and so I think, you know, I don't know how much to credit the original movie, but like clearly there was like a mythology there.
Yeah.
That, like, if they were able to mine all of that from it, I don't know. And I do love the show.
It's great.
Yeah, especially as, I mean, obviously it's within the Fargo universe or whatever, but it is largely just a Coen series of homage. But I'm going Fargo.
You don't think they'll True Detective the Coens out of there?
It's tough because, like, we're going, it's like one of the great blue collar crime movies of all time
ever
versus a collection of some of the best comedic performances of all time, right? Like, it's not just how great Jeff Bridges is and how iconic he is as the dude. It's the, like, this volcanic anger from John Goodman as Walter. It's John Turturro as the Jesus. It's like Julianne Moore even showing up in that movie. I always forget just she's in it, but even like Philip Seymour Hoffman's like weird, uncomfortable laugh after Tara Reid shows up, like, just is burned into my brain. There's so much of that movie that is like, so memorable and so hilarious, but I think I'm gonna give the edge to Fargo. I think
a bit about the eyes.
What part with the eyes? Yeah.
My man used to tell the Coens, "Hey, let me know if he smoked something on the way from point A to point B." And if the Coens said, "Yeah, he did," for The Big Lebowski, he would go for like 10 seconds, mess with his eyes just so he can come off in the scene. Like he smoked, according to the Coen brothers.
It's a great performance.
There's so many just inklings in there, so shout out to Big Lebowski, but yeah. I can't argue with Fargo. It's ridiculous. You sound goofy going, like, against it.
Yeah, this is a matchup that very easily could have been the finals. They're not, like, my 2 or 3 favorite Coen brothers movies, but they are classics for a reason. So Fargo makes its way into our semifinals. On the other side of the bracket, we've got No Country for Old Men versus Burn After Reading. I'm going to go with No Country for Old Men here. As much as I enjoy Burn After Reading, I kind of feel like No Country is a pitch-perfect thriller in a lot of ways. Taylor, how about you? Are you going No Country or are you going to go Burn After Reading?
Yeah, I'm going to go No Country. Undeniable movie. Like you said, pitch, everyone's just at the apex of their game. And even if it were it sort of had their typical cutting rhythms or whatever and played out in a more or less conventional narrative, it would still probably be near the top of their films. but there are just so many small moments where they're sort of redefining how we understand the grammar of the genre. Obviously, the two standouts being the hard cut at the end and not seeing Llewellyn, is that his name?
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. His death, which when you talk about it, it's hard to, I don't know, I feel like I'm inclined to just call it subversive, and that feels like not necessarily worthy of like it having GOAT status, but I don't know. It's
a pretty bold just like denial of the expectations for a film like that, right? Like they know what an audience sort of wants from that moment, and they decide that that's not the movie they're talking about. That's not the story they're telling. And yeah. I think it's beyond just a really bold story choice. It's a like really well executed moment. It's one of the few moments where like the camera starts to get really handheld and shaky and kind of give you that sort of urgency and chaos too. I don't know. There's so much to dig into how they put No Country together. So much to appreciate about that movie, and not that there isn't about Burn after reading, but
yeah,
it's the reason I'm going to go No Country. Art, we were just talking about it. You hadn't seen Burn After Reading until we watched it together recently. What was the funniest part of the movie for you?
Well, I feel like I've spoiled a bunch. I mean, everyone's seen this. I've seen like the chair bit for whatever reason on my timeline. Like that's normal to be doing. You know who you didn't mention? The boss. What's his name? Who plays the boss?
Richard Jenkins.
In Burn After Reading. Richard Jenkins comes in there, and he
great
is delightful as just like almost holding himself back. he was great in it, so I'm gonna throw some love his way. And then also when you had said, I see why you thought JK, because that was a JK slap in the car. That, you know, that was that type of energy.
Yes.
No Country for Old Men is the movie out of all of these that I have been thinking about the most, just like at a deep emotional level. I have enjoyed some of these. Raising Arizona is a movie that I think is hilarious and is such a good time, and I want to watch again. No Country for Old Men gave me what I thought I was going to get with a serious man's rewatch, and I think that's what really threw me for a loop going into the bracket, is I had respect for No Country and a lot of adoration for Serious Man. And No Country and all of its discussions and that ending and the talk that you and I had as well that we recorded – It's that movie. It's that movie, bro.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a
great film. Next matchup is between Inside Llewyn Davis and Hail Caesar. Taylor, do you have Hail Caesar above Inside Llewyn Davis?
Unfortunately, I do not. After that whole spiel, I have to hand it to Inside Llewyn Davis. I don't know. Maybe we can talk about it a little more in the next round, because I feel like the next one is a lot tougher of a matchup, even though, again, love Hail Caesar, came around on it. But Inside Llewyn Davis is a clear winner for me here.
Definitely. All right, so let's talk about the semifinal matchups, starting with Raising Arizona and Fargo. A lot more love than I expected going Raising Arizona's way. But Art, are you going to take Raising Arizona above Fargo?
Oh, no, baby, I didn't see your Fargo.
Taylor, did you have a favorite, like, bit or moment from Raising Arizona?
I really loved just the whole sequence with Frances McDormand and the... I forget who plays the foreman.
I'll try to bring it up for you.
And just the... I don't know, something that's... I don't know if I can say it's underrated about that movie. I haven't read too much discussion about it yet, but just the, I don't know, sort of, obviously Nick Cage is doing like 100 different things in that movie, but just the sort of melancholy of it all. I feel like he's done very like big operatic, sad characters, but this is just such a like, worn down by everyday life character. Mm-hmm. And just watching him talk to the foreman, literally like talking with your coworkers it's just such a... I was going to say that as like a... It feels like when you're talking to your coworker, but you're literally talking to your coworker.
Yeah.
Or Hayes. And even just like... There's so much that's pulled from that conversation alone, like the setup and payoff with the Pollock jokes. And also, I mean, speaking of that resolution, how the movie sort of has its whole denouement as a big what if in Hai's dream sequence. I don't know. I think I've seen the movie too recently to fully let it like gestate. So I'm probably still going to go Fargo just because it was, I think it was one of my first Coen brother movies, and it's stayed at the top through the whole nine.
Yeah.
Yeah,
McMurray is your guy who played Glenn, the foreman. Two, Zach, the answer is the baby leather boots. When those get presented from the biker, I lost it.
That's a great one. I've just always loved like Nick Cage's just whole like look and demeanor. He reminds me so much of like Wile E. Coyote in this movie. He's just got like a very Looney Tunes face.
I was hearing them talk about how they were sick of like his ad libs in it, and I can only imagine the hell they went through. But what a product at the end of it. Fargo's been Raising Arizona is fantastic.
Well, he was also supposedly pretty frustrated with them in the whole
right.
I think they both had their own ideas, and they were the directors, and it's a shame they haven't worked together since.
Right? Because like it's so magical even with all the turmoil.
Yeah, and it's also a stage in their career where, like, Nick Cage is, like, starting to get acclaim and stuff, but he's not yet, like, Nick Cage, and they're certainly not yet the Coen brothers, so unfortunately... Haven't gone back to that well yet. Maybe there's still time. Maybe in the horror movie. All right. This is maybe the toughest matchup we've had so far. Inside Llewyn Davis versus No Country for Old Men. Arturo, you said that you were thinking a lot about No Country for Old Men on your rewatches, but I know that you like Inside Llewyn Davis as well.
It's my
Which way are you going to go?
These are top two. It's one and two. I don't care. It ends for me here. Like, I don't... This is the end of my bracket. Fargo's three for me, so...
Throw the flag.
You know? Call it! Inside Llewyn Davis. Inside Llewyn Davis. Maybe. Inside Llewyn Davis.
You seem very sure of your decision.
You know, like, I see you log these things, and I ain't see you log... not Inside Country for Old Men. I saw you log inside Llewyn Davis. You went through all the special features of that bad boy. Because you live in that movie fully. Mm-hmm. I love the intro. You're just in there and he sings the whole song. This is a movie that understood what I feel a lot of music-based stuff is barely getting. Let the singers breathe. Show me the whole recording session. Let them live.
Yeah, there's...
I will rewatch Inside any day, I think, before No Country. We had that bit about, like, No Country's really good, but we're like, are you watching it Saturday with the boys? Not that Inside is either. But I think I'm still going to keep Inside as my number one Coen film.
I'm throwing on the Inside Llewyn Davis soundtrack Saturday with the boys, though. You know, sing some 500 Miles with my bros. I really, really
Dear
love
Mr.
Inside
Mr. President,
Llewyn
you
Davis.
And me on the way to South by.
Outer space. Inside Llewyn Davis, as you mentioned, I went through all the special features. Thank you, the Criterion Channel.
And you have a great review too. It's a fantastic Letterboxd review. I like your
thank
final
you
line of it.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's the one thing that I did mention in that review is that I think there has rarely been a greater match of performer to role than there is between Oscar Isaac and this part. Like, he's just able to fully crazy, embody dude. It in a way where you kind of forget you're watching a movie and you just feel like you're watching a guy. He just has that, you know, folk singer look to him, the way he carries himself. He's also able to really kind of get the miserable, sad sack, curmudgeonly nature of him and then turn around and sing angelically in a way where you believe he could help pack coffee houses on the Lower East Side.
I saw Dune. and this back-to-back, and I just realized I saw the back-to-back and I didn't even think about him. That's how.
Chameleonic, yeah, and he's probably one of our best movie stars at being at just disappearing into parts. My pick. But yeah, he's so excellent here. Yeah, I don't know. I love that one, but I think there's not a false note in No Country for Old Men. I think that to me is like as close to a perfect thriller as I think you get. I just really love that one. So I don't know. I think we're gonna go No Country for Old Men and make Taylor take the hard decision.
Good choice.
Well, it is a little tough for me. I mean, thinking of this in the macro as a Coen Brothers bracket, again, No Country is this apex for them, on their own and also with so many, maybe not that many of their collaborators, but I feel like it's also Roger Deakins at the top of his game, and I feel like he's so responsible for the look of their films. And so in that sense, Inside Llewyn Davis is almost a bit of an outlier for them, but just comparing also, the two, and I've watched No Country for Old Men on Saturday with the boys.
What's his name?
Bruno
Delbonnel. Yeah. Sorry, I interrupted you.
Oh no, I was just gonna say like it feels like a bit of an outlier, but it's sort of singular for that very reason. And just comparing the two movies, I don't want to say get so much more out of Inside Llewyn Davis, but it's just a full body emotional experience. And it really weaponizes that balance of like, I don't know, so much pathos is put into this movie, and it has that Coen nothing matters gut punch when he's meeting with what's his name?
The F. Murray Abraham.
Abraham. And after all that, he's just like, no, I don't think there's a future in this. but it's for once, it's like, maybe not for once, but it feels like rather than being like a gut punch for the audience, we're sort of feeling it vicariously and sort of adding to our, I don't know, empathy with Llewyn himself and just what it has to say about art as industry as a whole. I don't know. That's my number one Coen as well.
It also does this really amazing thing where it...
Thank you.
It makes you empathize with him and then immediately makes you think he's an asshole.
Oh,
and they constantly
ride
that line between like, do I feel bad for this guy or do I think he kind of deserves this?
He's a piece of crap and you follow him the whole time.
Like, yeah.
I'm very picky with cats in movies. It's like I feel what filmmakers use to get a lot of the audience to be like, oh, a cat. Best cat in cinema.
Yeah.
I agree.
Y'all heard that theory? And this was like, I can't even remember where I heard this, that it's supposed to be commenting on the cat book of the script that had come out around there.
Save the Cat script?
The Save the Cat thing. And that was kind of a play of what they were trying to do with the cat in the script. again, not to comment too much on that, but that was like something that approached my timeline. I was like, I've never seen that take. So, again, just the idea that they were able to take a miserable guy and I'd watch it again in a heartbeat right now.
I think about the scene where he's at dinner and they're like, oh, come on, play something for us. And he's like, this is my job. You don't understand. I think about that probably more than any other Coen scene.
Anytime somebody asks me for my opinion on a movie,
I'm off the clock.
Can't talk about that.
Well, okay. If we're gonna vote out No Country for Old Men, do we want to give it a little bit of a requiem here? Any last words for one of the great films and the one that won them their Oscars?
It's probably one of the best movies of the 21st century. It's just not their best movie. I'm sorry, they're really good filmmakers. It's one of those. It should win this. And you know what? Maybe it did win this. Maybe Zach will do a puncture movement or whatever and figure out a way to get us to vote the other way. But what I see is three classic films here, and they're all great.
Yeah, can we get another take where you guys say that this one?
We'll decide in the edit.
Yeah, exactly.
Roderick James will cut it.
We have a whole other video coming out where we talk more about No Country for Old Men in Fargo. But I'd say a lot of what I love about No Country in that. But I think in particular, the way that they're able to build these incredibly tense sequences without dialogue, without music, which is such a departure for, I think, the way that they normally do these movies. It's just really, really exciting, and it leaves you on the edge of your seat the whole time. I love so much about that movie. Taylor, anything else about No Country, or should we get into our final matchup?
I don't know. I don't have too much else to add. Incredible supporting cast in these bit roles. That's not necessarily out of the norm for the Coens, but again, here it feels particularly like an apex. And
it's one of those movies where they get like Steven Root to show up for one or two scenes, and it's like, mm-hmm. Oh, that's like an uncle I haven't seen in a couple of years. What's going on? Exactly.
This isn't a full meme, but you were asking about Coen Brothers memes, and there is a meme-like quality to No Country for Old Men gas station guy. Like every single time he appears, is that not the first thing we hear? Every right. single time, even when he was just in Killers, like right. in real reviews, they were like mentioning him and then going, No Country for Old Men. I feel like that's just become such a staple.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there are definitely, I mean, I feel like, you know, what's the most you ever lost on a coin toss is up there as a Coen meme. I think of what use was whatever if it brought you here. I think that's another one that's pretty big. Maybe not quite as big as the Buster Scruggs one, but credit where credit's due.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I will also say, for the record, I'm with Art. I'm team There Will Be Blood.
I was just between the two movies.
Yeah, There Will Be Blood is probably where'd you go? Are you grabbing something?
He ascended.
Oh, this died on me too, dude. So I think this is about to die. Thank you.
Oh, jeez.
Appreciate it.
Yeah. All right. So No Country for Old Men.
Zach, what is your order with these three? Including
with these
Fargo.
Three?
We're including Fargo on that semi that we just said, knowing that No Country.
Yeah, well, so look, both of you just said that Inside Llewyn Davis is your favorite Coen Brothers movie. So I think that takes a little bit of suspense out of the final. So I got Fargo at number four. I got Inside Llewyn Davis at number three. I got No Country for Old Men at number two. And I got A Serious Man at number one, which means I'm going with Inside over Fargo as well.
Yeah, I think I got Fargo at four. My third one is Big Lebowski in there instead, I believe.
Ooh.
They're raising Arizona,
Taylor,
surprisingly,
this
time.
Do you have a top five off the top of your head, or is that a tough question to ask with all these movies?
I think I've got a rough top five. Inside Llewyn Davis, number one. For a while, Fargo was number two, but in recent years, I have come around on No Country as number two. Nice. Then Fargo. And then... what's that? That's only three?
Mm-hmm.
I'll say Hail Caesar and Raising Arizona.
Hey, okay. I'm glad that Raising Arizona made it that high up your list.
I had high expectations, and it just...
Yeah.
Great movie.
This I also have too. With the yodeling song that they did. Yeah, it's incredible. It's
pretty good.
We did not talk about Carter Burwell enough to my liking for this podcast.
Yeah.
The score in Raising Arizona, the score in Hudsucker Proxy, which is again also very like Looney Tunes. Fargo, one of the all-timer film scores, the way that the music swells as like the car comes through the blinding snow. And not that this is Carter Burwell, but the music in Inside Llewyn Davis, we could also spend a whole other podcast just talking about all that. Such amazing stuff. To wrap up that top five question, I mentioned my top four. Hudsucker Proxy is the one that made its way into my top five.
That's your Raising Arizona?
Yeah, that's my Raising Arizona of this round. Art, did you have a fifth choice? I don't know if you gave us a top five.
Okay, I said Inside, No Country, what's the name? Big Lebowski, Fargo, my fifth. You know, A Simple Man dropped. I guess that's my question for you. A Serious Man. Like, did you have one that didn't...
That dropped?
Yeah. Because I think A Serious Man would have cleared my five, and it's like, is it's either Burn or Raising now.
Yeah, I think it's Blood Simple is probably the one that dropped the most from me. I had it a lot higher up before. Most of them I liked more this time through.
Okay. I did not like A Serious Man, like, oh, this movie ruined what I thought of it was. Right. I think watching it with like all of them, it really humbled the position where I had A Serious Man, if that makes sense. Kind of the same way that No Country, I think, would clear so many other movies, including Inside Llewyn Davis. But in the context of like what we think is the movie that defines them, yeah, it probably should be No Country for Old Men. But it could also be Inside Llewyn Davis or Fargo is really what I'm saying.
Yeah. Taylor, what do you think? Do you think people will agree with our general assessments here? Are we on the right track giving the crown to Inside Llewyn Davis?
I think we'll probably get some flack for not having No Country as number one, but I think the best alternative is Inside Llewyn Davis. I think we skated pretty close to the curb on that one.
All right, one last question I'm just thinking about, because there is such a plethora of amazing performances to choose from. Do either of you have a favorite performance from any of the Coen Brothers movies? Again, there are just a incredible assortment to choose from. Just trying to go off the top of my head. It's really tough. Going back to A Serious Man, I just think Michael Stuhlbarg is so incredible in that one. Really carrying what I think is kind of like a difficult part as well. And maybe just the 1-2 punch of him and Fred Melamed as Cy Abelman is great in that movie. Taylor, you have one?
You know, I probably don't believe this, but I can't think of anyone else. It's Hobie Doyle. Like, you asked the question, and I thought Hobie Doyle, and I was like, it's got to be someone else. And I could not think of anyone else.
How about you, Arturo? Anything coming to mind?
You know, Curly from Drive Away Dolls was fantastic.
Shout out, Bill
Camp.
He
got a bunch of claps. In Inside Llewyn Davis, Carrie Mulligan is incredible. She is really good in that movie. I had obviously mentioned what's her name in True Grit, which I continue to just not say her name, so I guess I have not said Hailee Steinfeld. But I had said it earlier. My favorite performance is The Big Lebowski. I just, for what's his name, John Goodman, that energy that he brings in is just, it's insane. And
he's so good.
Seeing him in so many other stuff, like again, his role, while tinier in Raising Arizona, he's bringing in that menacing energy again. And you were like talking about it with Barton Fink. He's just this big presence, and I think Big Lebowski is where he just goes over the edge with it. The outfit, all of it.
Yeah.
So I'm a
John
fan
Goodman.
For sure.
John Goodman's like one of my favorite actors, and I just love when he works with the Coen brothers, because I think they really just get what is incredible about him. That immense power that he has. We were talking about Inside Llewyn Davis, just him in the car is so good.
He's in the trailer saying that nonsense.
Yeah.
When he makes fun of him for jumping off the George Washington Bridge.
Who says that? Him.
So good.
What it is that no matter what movie, I'm looking forward to his character, because I know that that's going to be some of the best scenes of the film. So he's my favorite actor with them in general.
All right. Well, thank you guys for helping us get to the bottom of what is the best Coen Brothers movie. Obviously, it's Inside Llewyn Davis. Taylor, really, really appreciate you joining us for another one of these. Where can people find more from you?
You know, I'm still doing my thing on my channel.
Hell yeah.
Taylor J. Williams. I have been starting to do a few more things over on my Patreon that you can access for just $1 a month.
Nice.
I've had monthly recaps of basically just everything I watched in a month. I've been doing that for like 2 years now, but I've just started doing patron chosen exclusive reviews each month. A little less scripted, a little more just like going off of notes and being a little more spontaneous, but it's been fun so far. This next one coming up, we covered Gummo, which is fun.
Amazing.
So yeah, I mean, I would recommend that.
Definitely. Yeah. always recommend Taylor's channel. He's putting out some of the best film analysis, TV analysis out there. I need to catch up with your Curse video, but I recently sent your Asteroid City one to a friend because that was a very good one. So
thank you.
Definitely worth checking up on Taylor's videos. You can find more from me at Zshevich across social media or at Multiplex Show, wherever you find videos. Art, where can people find more from you?
You can find me over at LME Movies on Twitter, YouTube, Letterboxd, or every week here on the Intercut Podcast.
You can find every episode of the Intercut Podcast on iTunes, on Spotify, whatever your favorite podcatcher is. I like Overcast. And then make sure you subscribe not just to the audio podcast, but to the video podcast as well on youtube.com/intercutpod, where you can watch our tired faces. It's getting a little bit late here on the East Coast as we run through the latest in entertainment. Find new episodes of the Intercut Weekend must watch streaming on our YouTube channel every Monday, and please leave us a comment, like the video, and consider heading over to iTunes to give us that much requested 5-star review. Shout out to those of you in Mexico who put us on the TV and film charts out there. We're charting kind of high in Mexico recently.
I got a lot of cousins.
Gracias, right? I don't know. Follow us on Facebook, on Instagram, on Twitter, on Patreon. You can support us on patreon.com/intercutpod. You can also check out the link to our Discord in the description of this episode to get updates throughout the week from Art, from me, from Taylor, from any of the people that we feature here on this podcast. Thanks again for tuning in. And until next time, if it was never new and it never gets old, it's a folk song.